Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Florence made landfall this morning in North Carolina, where forecasters are warning of a once-in-a-millennia flood. Let's get the latest from meteorologist Jeff Huffman. He's director of South Carolina Emergency Information Network. And Jeff, this storm came ashore as a Category 1 storm, but we've been saying for days now that the real danger is the rain and the water. What are you seeing?
Yeah, Peter, not so much about the wind, although, of course, a much stronger hurricane would have caused much more damage where it came ashore near Wilmington earlier this morning. But, you know, I'd say 105 wind gusts there reported in Wilmington strong enough to cause considerable damage. But remember, the water, as it relates to storm surge, it doesn't care about what the wind speed is. It cares about how long this storm has been moving over the water and how strong those winds have been pushing that water. And for days, we've seen this major hurricane moving across the wide open Atlantic, and that's why the storm surge is so extensive. And then, of course, the rain is the problem. Is the storm is going to slow down even more. I mean, it's already slowing down to westerly motion at 6 miles per hour, and it could completely stall in the next 12 hours in eastern portions of South Carolina before it finally regains some momentum later tomorrow.
I do want to talk about the rainfall, but first, how about that storm surge that you mentioned? How bad is it, and where is it the worst?
I think it was up in the Newburgh area where the most extreme water level rise was in where the people live mostly, where there was a lot of population area there. That's where the water was most significant in that inlet up that river. Also in the Wilmington area, it's been significant as well. I've seen storm surge reports in the 10 to 12 feet range up in the Newburgh area.
What kind of damage does that do?
Well, water that high, if you think about it, it has velocity to it. The water is being driven by the wind, and that can completely move homes off their foundations. It can also, of course, move everything outside of a home, and of course, anybody trying to move around with that water is putting their life in grave danger. So, I think we're going to see sections of the coastline there in the Outer Banks that may be changed forever from this storm surge as it relates to Florence.
Now, before the storm hit, there was a forecast that said in some places there could be 40 inches of rain, which is a remarkable amount of water. Are we on track for that? What are the forecasts showing?
Yeah, we've already seen several reports in the 10 to 20-inch range coming out of southern portions of North Carolina. Some of the latest reports, Oriental North Carolina, 18.5, Surf City, 14 inches, Morehead City, 13.8, Jacksonville, North Carolina, 13. I think those areas could see another 6 to 10 inches of rain before this winds down. So that's going to put it solidly in the 20 to 30-inch range. And, Peter, I'm concerned. I don't know if it's been talked about enough. I'm concerned that as the storm slows down and stalls over portions of South Carolina. Let's say the storm is near Florence. The feeder bands into this will stretch all the way up to the Greensboro, Raleigh, Durham area of North Carolina, back down to Wilmington, where there's already been the 20 inches of rain so far in some areas. I think that corridor right along from Greensboro to Raleigh down to Wilmington, I think you need to prepare for potentially catastrophic flooding, not only from flash flooding, but also the river flooding that will take place for days after. That's in addition to the heavy rain that, of course, will be occurring with the storm as it moves into portions of South Carolina.
It's just like Hurricane Harvey. It's the problems in the days that follow that really create the misery for people.
Go ahead. One thing to remember is that we have all this water with nowhere to go now along the coastline, and we have water that'll be falling upstream. This is a little different from Harvey in the sense that we're going to have an extreme runoff situation through all the rivers and tributaries, and many of them are already forecast to go into major flood stage. National Weather Service saying a few of them could even break record levels. So that's a little different than Harvey, is that the runoff will continue probably for the next week or two.
Power outages, what can you tell us about that?
They have been widespread in portions of North Carolina. Moving into South Carolina, power outages is likely to be widespread in the Myrtle Beach area as the core of that storm gets a little closer later tonight. The good thing, Peter, I guess with the wind speed diminishing, the power outages will not extend as far inland as once feared with this. So not as many in the Columbia area, not as many in the Charlotte area, unless you get one of those outer bands that produces an isolated tornado.
Okay, so there are a lot of people impacted by this storm along the coast. But what about residents further inland upstate in the Carolinas.
There's still going to be 12 to 24 hours of very heavy rain, maybe 36 hours up in the North Carolina area. And remember, that could cause flash flooding. But even though you haven't seen anything yet and you're not going to see anything in upstate South Carolina or North Carolina till at least tomorrow night, you're still susceptible to flooding from Florence all the way through Monday or Tuesday.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Meteorologist Jeff Huffman, director of South Carolina's Emergency Information Network. Jeff, appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Always my pleasure.
Well, I am just back from a trip to the Midwest. I was at member station WFYI in Indianapolis yesterday, where we were doing some election reporting ahead of the midterms. You can find those stories at hereandnow.org. There is another story from Indiana we want to bring you now about the state's school choice program. It is the largest in the country. It's often held up as a national model. President Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos are big supporters. School choice has always been controversial, but now, with a disagreement over LGBTQ rights, Indiana may see a new battle over what it means to use public dollars in a private space. Carter Barrett from WFYI reports.
In early August, Shelley Fitzgerald received an email from her principal and immediately knew something was wrong. For 15 years, she's been a guidance counselor at a private Catholic high school in Indianapolis.
So immediately, I called or emailed our principal to ask him if I should be concerned. And he gave me a little bit of a heads up what was going on, that someone had turned in my marriage certificate.
Fitzgerald is married to a woman, her partner of 22 years. Roncalli High School in the Archdiocese of Indianapolis said this marriage violates her contract with the Archdiocese. They gave her these options: dissolve her marriage or finish out the year and quietly resign.
I immediately let them know that I had no intention of dissolving my marriage. I had no intention of resigning, and, you know, that I was going to tell the people that I loved what was going on, why I had to leave the school.
Roncalli High School received approximately $1.5 million of state funds last year in school vouchers. This is public money.
And when you start to discriminate against people with public dollars, that becomes a big issue.
This is Democratic State Representative Dan Forrestal, who's also a Roncalli graduate.
It's been very disappointing to see Roncalli and the Archdiocese of Indianapolis discriminate against Shelley Fitzgerald because of who she loves.
In Indiana, the money follows the student. Neighborhood public schools receive state money for each student enrolled. But if a family financially qualifies for a voucher, it could take up to 90% of the state money allocated for that student and use it at a private school, secular or religious. About half of Indiana students qualify for this program.
I mean, we cannot allow public dollars to be funneled to institutions who then turn around and discriminate against people who paid those public dollars.
Forrestal says he plans to introduce a bill to disqualify schools for vouchers if they have discriminatory LGBTQ policies. But school choice supporters say the money isn't public because parents decide where the voucher goes. Here's Republican State Senator and author of School Choice Policy in Indiana, Bob Boehnig.
It's a dilemma and a struggle that we're going to have to work through, but it is not as easy as saying, well, vouchers equals state money, because it really is the parents making the choice.
Boehnig says the Catholic high school has a right to its religious beliefs, and parents have a right to choose schools with those beliefs.
I mean, that's probably the uniqueness, and one of the things that we wanted to keep unique about the choice system is that parents are the ones that are empowered to make these decisions and not government.
State Representative Forrestal counters.
If your uniqueness is the ability to discriminate against someone because of their sexual orientation, then that is not something that we should be protecting.
Andrew Downs heads a nonpartisan think tank that focuses on Indiana politics. He says Forrestal's bill could be the issue this legislative session that gets traction. Republican Governor Eric Holcomb recently called for hate crime legislation, a move resisted by lawmakers in past years. But now, some of those same state legislators may be motivated to consider anti-discriminatory measures.
It's something that is very exciting in the moment. 2, 3, 4 years from now, people may not think much about it, but at this moment, it's very important.
But Downs also notes the author of the school voucher law, State Senator Boehnig, is chair of the Education Committee, and he has significant influence over which bills are heard and which ones are not. Legislators could also decide to leave it up to the courts. For now, many at Roncalli High School are focused on what's going to happen to their guidance counselor. At the opening season football game, the student section wore rainbows and waved flags to show their support. The opposing team's fans wore rainbow colors as well. Here's Roncalli senior Riley Seddon. She was one of the organizers for the protest.
Just like, carried by 24
the
Andrew
love and
Locker.
Support that's happening around here right now is honestly, it's really special, and it's brought us all together. And just like, if everyone can do that, the world would be such a much better place.
Fitzgerald, a Roncalli graduate herself, says the outpouring of support lets her know the Roncalli family is still with her. But she hopes to see the change that wouldn't allow private schools to discriminate against the LGBTQ community.
To me, the fix I would hate to see for our school to lose vouchers or state funding at all, because, again, I think that those people, the people who are receiving the vouchers are part of our family. But at the same time, so am I.
Shelley Fitzgerald is still on administrative leave. The Archdiocese of Indianapolis and Roncalli High School declined comment for this story since Shelley Fitzgerald is still an employee. But the superintendent of Catholic schools in Indianapolis provided a statement saying they welcome all students and families who desire a quality Catholic education, and school choice lets non-public schools teach students aligned to a mission and with limited regulation. If this case goes to the court, it could take years to make a decision, but it could be a landmark case for the future of school vouchers across the country. For Here and Now, I'm Carter Barrett.
And reporters Eric Weddle and Lauren Chapman contributed to that report. Regardless of your politics, at some point during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, you've probably thought, does a Supreme Court nomination have to be so partisan and so polarizing? Well, our neighbor to the north says no. Many Canadians can't name a sitting justice on their Supreme Court, and that's not because they're ignorant. Joining us now from Toronto is Adam Goldenberg, who's a lawyer and professor at the University of Toronto and was a clerk to former Supreme Court Chief Justice in Canada, Beverly McLaughlin. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So how does the process work in Canada?
So it's a lot less political. In Canada, the Prime Minister is the chief advisor to the Governor General, who's the Queen's representative in Canada. And the Prime Minister gives the Governor General a name, and that person is appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. There's no necessity for any sort of legislative hearing or other process before the person is appointed, although different governments in the past have chosen by their own volition to have some kind of public hearing. The last couple of appointments by the current government have involved some questioning by members of parliament, although it's far more gentle than what Judge Kavanaugh just went through down there in the United States. And then there have been some public Q&As with law students and legal academics at the University of Ottawa. So it's a much more informal process, and none of it is constitutionally mandated. The only thing that the government has to do is pick a name.
But then how do you make sure that the government isn't just putting in people that agree with the government?
So there is no procedural means of making sure of that. They're simply constitutional norms and traditions that say the government doesn't do that. And history shows that Canadian governments don't do that. The culture of the Canadian Supreme Court is profoundly different, I'd suggest, than the culture of the U.S. Supreme Court. And the culture around judging in general is different in Canada than it is in the United States. You don't see the partisanship around judicial appointments here that you do there. So, for example, the last government, the Conservative government led by Prime Minister Stephen Harper, by the end of his time in office, had appointed 7 of the 9 judges on the Supreme Court of Canada, and nobody really could tell the difference. The government was still losing appeals on law and order issues. The Supreme Court struck down laws against sex work, against doctor-assisted suicide. It upheld a constitutional right to use medical marijuana, and it even struck down mandatory minimums, which was a significant part of the former government's platform. In the U.S., you would expect highly polarized political issues like that to be decided on 5-4 votes, almost on party line votes, like in a legislative body. In Canada, it's much harder to call how an individual judge will vote based on which party put them on the court.
Yeah, I've heard that almost all of them are considered swing justices.
Exactly. It's like, as imagine a court where you have of 9 judges, at least 7 at any one time are Anthony Kennedy.
Huh. Interesting. How powerful is the court in Canada?
So politically speaking, it is not really any less powerful than the Supreme Court is in the U.S. For all practical purposes, the Supreme Court is the final court of appeal for all constitutional questions in Canada. The one difference that you have in the Canadian context is there's a legislative override clause written into our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is the equivalent of the Bill of Rights. So whereas in the United States, if, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court says the legislature, Congress, cannot do X because it violates the First Amendment, in Canada, if a law were found to infringe Section 2B of the Charter, which is the equivalent of the First Amendment, the Parliament of Canada or a provincial legislature could invoke what's called the notwithstanding clause, Section 33 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And so the legislature does have the power to override the Supreme Court, although that power is used incredibly sparingly because there are political consequences to using it. And some commentators, particularly in the United States, suggest that this makes the form of judicial review we have in Canada qualitatively weaker than what you see in the United States. But for practical purposes, when the Supreme Court strikes down a law, it stays struck down.
A lot of the fights that involve the Supreme Court in this country have to do with how closely the justices are keeping their rulings to the Constitution, which was written hundreds of years ago. In Canada, your Constitution was written, what, in 1982?
So there are two parts of the Constitution. Right. Yeah, the Bill of Rights part, the Charter, was enacted in 1982. So there aren't really a lot of debates about, well, what were they really thinking?
Right.
What did this
right.
word mean all the way back in the 80s? There is much more academic work to be done when you're trying to figure out what a document that was enacted in 1789 is meant to say. That said, there are other provisions in the Canadian Constitution, the division of powers and the federalism provisions, which date back to 1867. And there are still other parts of the Constitution which exist in other statutes and that are even unwritten in the British tradition. So there is a lot of interpretation that does go on. That being said, in the U.S., the debate that happens now around constitutional interpretation and constitutional meaning is largely informed by forces in legal academia and in politics that were inspired by conservative backlash to rulings that the Warren Court made in the 1960s and that had continued then in the 80s, particularly when Ronald Reagan was in the White House. And there was a deliberate effort on the part of the Reagan Justice Department to choose judges whose judicial philosophy aligned with conservative policy outcomes. So the originalism that Antonin Scalia so famously expounded as a U.S. Supreme Court justice and as an academic before he was a judge, and that other judges like Robert Bork, who was almost a U.S. Supreme Court judge, were famous for expounding, were largely generated by a deliberate effort to create a conservative response to the Warren Court's liberalism and a string of decisions in the 60s, and we all know them, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, right. That was in the 50s, Miranda and Arizona, Gideon and Wainwright, decisions that the conservative movement in the United States took real exception to.
So you don't have something like that? You don't have a Federalist Society or a Heritage Foundation that gets in touch with the Prime Minister and says this is who you should appoint to the Supreme Court?
So we do have conservative legal organizations that do important work and that do the important job of making sure there is diversity in the legal academy and in the judiciary, but they don't have the same kind of influence that the Federalist Society does in the U.S. There is no, for example, equivalent to Leonard Leo, who's the executive vice president of FedSoc, who actually drafts a list that goes to the president that the president, in President Trump's case, chooses all of his Supreme Court picks from. There's nothing like that in Canada, nor is there the well-established pipeline for both liberal and conservative law students in the U.S. to become liberal or conservative judges, or first law clerks and then government lawyers and then private practice lawyers and then judges and then appellate judges and then Supreme Court justices. In Canada, there is nothing like that level of organization, nor has there ever been.
In the U.S., 50% of people identify as Republican or Democrat. In Canada, and this is amazing, just one in 600 people claim a party. So do you think that the Supreme Court is less partisan in Canada just because Canadians are less partisan?
Yeah, I do. So the statistic there, the one in 600 number, is an estimate. And what it represents is the number of Canadians that actually go out and join a political party. Mm-hmm. So in the U.S., if I were an American and I wanted to become a Democrat, I would simply say to no one in particular, I am now a Democrat. And or I would register as a Democrat right. with the state government. In Canada, there is no equivalent to that. If you want to become a liberal in Canada, you have to join the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party actually recently made this dramatic move to open up its membership by getting rid of membership fees. The other parties, you actually have to pay money. And that, of course, is very different than in the United States. So very few Canadians actually take the step of formally affiliating themselves with a political party. That isn't to say that Canadians don't identify as being more or less aligned with one party or another. But in the U.S., when you say you're a Democrat, that means a lot more than saying I vote liberal in Canada. And so, yes, Canadians are less partisan than Americans are. And so Americans expect each other to be more partisan than Canadians expect each other to be. Judges who reach the Supreme Court in Canada, it doesn't even cross one's mind to think, in most cases, is this person a liberal? Are they a conservative? Because chances are they aren't in the technical sense of the term.
So as you watch the Kavanaugh process go on, what do you think? Which is a better system?
Well, I think the U.S. system is borderline insane. I know that and I say that with great respect to the U.S. constitutional tradition. The Senate has to advise and consent on these sorts of issues. And there is a constitutional imperative to do things the way that the U.S. does them. That being said, Senate Judiciary Committee hearings were not always this way. Both parties share responsibility for that. I mean, the Robert Bork hearings and the hearings around Clarence Thomas's appointments back in the 80s, these were the watershed moments in turning the Senate Judiciary Committee into the political madhouse that it is today around Supreme Court nominations. But I do think that when you have judicial appointments become such a partisan issue, there's a legitimacy problem for a high court. When people see 5-4 rulings on issues like gay marriage in Obergefell and Hodges, in campaign finance reform in Citizens United and Federal Election Commission, like more very recently on labor unions and the rights of non-labor union members to not pay union dues for political activities in the Janus case, which was just very recently decided. When these sorts of politically contentious issues, which are the subject of partisan contestation in the legislative context, are decided on 5-4 party line votes by the Supreme Court, it's no surprise that Americans take a judicial appointment to be like a lasting achievement for a Republican president to make the Supreme Court a Republican body for as long as the Republican members of the Supreme Court, and they are considered Republican, not just conservative, stay in that office. So how are you supposed to keep people trusting the decisions of a high court when they see it as an extension of politics? And in Canada, we've managed to avoid that partly by sheer luck, partly by different constitutional traditions that we have and different structures that we have in our Constitution, and partly because our judges quite simply are less predictable than yours are.
But it is colder in Canada. You'll accept that.
Well, we'll see. Climate change, you know, we're going to have tourists in the Arctic pretty soon.
It's Adam Goldenberg, who is a lawyer and professor at the University of Toronto. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Let's get back to our top story, Hurricane Florence. The city of New Bern, North Carolina, is among those already feeling the storm's impacts. Rescue efforts are underway. And joining us now from New Bern is Amber Parker, a spokesperson for Craven County. Amber, what are conditions like there now?
What we're seeing here in Craven County, of course, we have this flood, storm surge, wind. We're certainly happy now to at least have daylight on our side. It was a little dark there for several hours to where it made rescue operations much more difficult.
And New Bern is right on the water there, right?
It is. It's right where the Neuse River and Trent River come together.
And so have you seen flooding from that, from the water sources?
Oh, yes, we have, especially from the Neuse River. The storm surge actually started pushing up yesterday, you know, as winds come in, and then we have different water levels based on high tide. And so, yeah, we've seen a lot of river flooding.
Are the roads passable?
No. Some roads are passable, but there are a lot of roads that are impassable due to water. And that started yesterday afternoon, and that continues today.
So tell us about the rescue efforts going on there in New Bern where you are.
Yes, right now we have currently 5 Swiftwater rescue teams out assisting individuals, including, we also have the Louisiana Cajun Navy out there, and they are out there just trying to get to people as fast as they can. We have people trapped by the storm surge and flooding waters, getting to the steps of their house. We've had it reported to where it's over mailboxes, to the stairs of homes, even first, second floors to where people are having to get on their roofs.
How many people are trapped?
I don't have an exact number of the people trapped. I do know we have more than 100 calls, and the calls usually have multiple individuals who need assistance. I do know specifically one call that came in. There were 9 people who needed help.
Hmm. So does this mean that people weren't listening to evacuation orders?
Right. That's what I would think. Craven County did issue a state of emergency on Monday, and Tuesday morning issued a voluntary evacuation for the low-lying areas of Craven County. And by 2 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, that voluntary evacuation had turned into a mandatory evacuation. And our Craven County shelters currently have 939 residents in them.
Now, you're talking to us on a landline telephone. Do people have service in order to call you and tell you that they're in trouble, or are they calling from their landlines?
I'm not sure which numbers they're actually calling from. Our phones have been ringing. It slowed down a little bit this morning compared to what it was when it first started getting dark, but we are getting phone calls. Messages are also coming from family members of individuals who are trapped, reporting that their phone batteries are about to die. And, of course, now we've had people without power over the night, and so we don't really know if we're getting less calls because less people are trapped or if it's that they don't have phone coverage to call.
How are you doing personally?
Personally, I'm doing great. This is my third hurricane that I have worked, my second one with Craven County. Of course, I live in New Bern. I'm a property owner here. I have friends that live here and have property here and work here, and it's devastating to see our beautiful community and parts of it underwater and, you know, to even worry about my own home. I don't know what the status of it is.
You don't know what the status of your own home is?
No, I don't. I live in Riverbend. One of the areas where people were having to be rescued off their roofs.
Wow. Well, good luck to you, and thanks so much
for
taking a few minutes for us, Amber.
Thank you, absolutely.
And we will continue to follow that story and all of the impacts of Hurricane Florence. That was Amber Parker, spokesperson for Craven County, North Carolina.
You might remember our next guest. She was on our show a few years ago talking about the children's book she'd written about her great-grandfather's pet bear, who happened to be the real-life inspiration for one of the most lovable characters in all of literature, Winnie the Pooh. Yes, Winnie was a real bear, purchased for $20 by a Canadian soldier named Harry Colburn. Harry was at a train station making his way from Winnipeg to Quebec to deploy for battle in the First World War. It was a story that Lindsay Maddock had long told her children. But as the kids grew up, they wanted to know more. And her new novel, Winnie's Great War, is full of details about Winnie's incredible life and the war that Harry Colburn was fighting. She joins us now from Toronto. Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What a story. And this is your story. It was your great-grandfather who ended up buying this orphaned bear at a train station. He named it after Winnie, his hometown of Winnipeg. What possessed him to buy a wild animal?
I love that question. It's a question I've thought a lot about. He loved animals. Animals were a part of Harry's life from a very young age, and that led him to become a veterinarian. And when he met Winnie in White River all those years ago, I think he saw an opportunity to really provide a source of joy to his fellow soldiers and probably himself as they were heading off.
A lot of the historical facts in this book are taken right from Harry Colburn's diaries and photographs, too. They're fascinating pictures. Where did you get these primary documents?
So the family archive, as we now call it, for a long time was really an old Corningware box with photographs and things that I, you know, had anxiety that one day my house would somehow burn down and all these items would not make it out into the world. So they're items that my grandfather, Harry's son, Fred, kept for many, many years. Fortunately for all of us in our family and now everyone else who's had the opportunity to see them, they really do serve as incredible proof points that this remarkable story actually happened.
Did the family know over the years that that was a treasure trove of history right there and that was so deeply connected to a very important moment in literature?
I think it really gained significance when in the late 1980s, there was a story that came out that gave credit to the ownership of Winnie to another regiment. Mm. And my grandfather, Harry's son Fred, who was very much a man of accuracy, went down at that point to get his father's 1914 diaries. At that point, the diaries certainly were the first piece in correcting the story.
Yeah, let's talk about Winnie's role in this great war. Because from the train station, Harry buys this lovable baby bear, and he makes a very bold decision to bring it with him to the military barracks. They travel to Quebec. Thousands of soldiers are there, hundreds of horses, and a man with this bear. This happened in real life. What was the response when this bear showed up into camp?
Well, none of us really know what the responses were, and certainly in Winnie's Great War, we took some creative liberties, and the colonel's not too happy in Winnie's Great War. But in real life, we don't totally know. What we do know is that mascots, including bears, were not entirely unusual. Winnie, believe it or not, was actually not the only bear mascot that came over during the First World War. And all kinds of animals throughout history, from goats to pigs to monkeys, have served as mascots.
So they eventually get on a ship and they go overseas. They land in Europe. Harry knows that he can't take the bear to the front lines. So he makes a very difficult decision. He, and this is backed up by history, he takes her to the zoo and then goes off to war.
He does. And we know that December the 9th, 1914, he writes in his diary that he brought Winnie to the London Zoo, and she had been with them for about 4 months. You know, many people thought the First World War would be over in, you know, not too short of a period of time. And of course, it lasted 4 years. So I think at the time, he probably didn't realize that he'd be leaving her for as long as he did. We know that he had written on the back of a photograph that he sent home to some family in Canada that one day Winnie would be coming back to Canada with him. Mm-hmm. So we think that was his intention, in fact, to bring her home. But clearly at the end of the war, she had found a new home with new friends.
What was her life like in the zoo?
From all accounts, it was a pretty great life. She was a very beloved bear. She was a star attraction at the London Zoo. There was a zookeeper who wrote that Winnie was the only bear they ever trusted entirely, mm-hmm. if you can believe it. I always thought, well, I don't know how you sort of partly trust a bear, but there was an obituary written when she died. She lived for 20 years, which is a long life for a bear, but it really talked about how much people loved her and children were allowed to go inside her enclosure and play with her.
Well, they better trust the bear then, in that case.
Exactly.
And that's how Winnie meets Christopher Robin, the young boy who eventually will inspire the book about Winnie the Pooh. I was hoping that you could read a little bit from your book, because you tackle some difficult subjects for a book that the audience is intended for children. I was hoping you could read from your great-grandfather's journal that is in this book.
So I'll share with you the April 22nd, 1915 entry. Shells burst almost at my feet. Germans gas French soldiers who retreat en masse. Hundreds of civilians and soldiers streaming down road out of Ypres. Old men carrying their wives on their backs. Terrible scenes. Canadian soldiers hold on grimly against great odds.
How do you write a book about war for children?
I think Josh and I, as we endeavored to put this book together, had many conversations about the best way to tell it, the best it could have been told through Harry's perspective.
And Josh is Josh Greenhut, your co-author.
Yes. We felt that including the actual diary entries was extremely important because it grounded a story which is really a blend of fact and fiction. So I think for kids to understand, while they're going to have this story told to them through the perspective of a bear who's going to go on these adventures and along the way befriend all kinds of animals and have different interactions that are, of course, fictional and interesting, but they will never leave the fact that this really happened by having those diary entries ground them in the realities. It brings to life that, of course, the war was very real for Harry. It was very real for his fellow soldiers. And I think the beauty of Winnie's Great War is that it allows us to tackle some pretty key themes when it comes to talking about war: duty, self-sacrifice, bravery. It allows us to do it in a way that I think is, you know, accessible for a younger audience.
And it's nice that something so wonderful could come out of something so terrible. What is the importance of this story to your family's identity?
It's very important to my family's identity. This story, you know, my whole life, I really have thought about how this story reminds you to be brave. It reminds you to be curious. It reminds you to be aware. And I think if there's a legacy that my great-grandfather's story has, it's that even in the most devastating of circumstances, going off to war, he found a way to find joy, find love, and those acts, those simple acts that he took, ended up having a very beautiful consequence in the form of inspiring one of the most beloved characters in children's literature.
When the war is over, Harry comes back to the zoo for a visit, and he's essentially saying goodbye to Winnie. He decides that he's not going to bring her back to Winnipeg. He says it's because Winnie will be better off at the zoo. But I'm also thinking that the war must have changed Harry. Have you thought about why he left the bear behind?
I have. I think that Harry, having read some of the entries like the one I just read, he talks about the sort of near misses that he experienced, witnessing 7,000 Canadian casualties, experiencing heavy fire and trying to save some of his things and those attempts failing. All those experiences that he would have had would have hardened him in some ways. And I think that the experience for him probably of seeing this animal that you loved in a place, in a new home, you know, she had visitors and children and families who would come to the zoo just to see her. And I think that he experienced and witnessed so much sacrifice. And I think for him to make a sacrifice of his own in making that decision to leave her, it would have been a natural decision, I think, at that point.
Lindsay Maddock, the new book is Winnie's Great War, describes your great-grandfather's journey from Winnipeg to England to fight in the First World War. And his story is the inspiration for none other than Winnie the Pooh. Lindsay, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Norm MacDonald has a show. That's the name of Netflix's latest attempt at a late-night style talk show. It debuted today. Norm MacDonald, you may remember, is the stand-up comic and the Saturday Night Live veteran. But where's he been lately? Well, the answer to that is he's been causing some controversy as he tries to rebuild his career with Netflix. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Let's start with the controversy. Norm MacDonald was disinvited from NBC's The Tonight Show this week for comments that he made defending fellow comedians Louis C.K. and Roseanne Barr, who have been in trouble for sexual misconduct and racist comments in the past. MacDonald then tried to apologize for those comments that he made, but then just made it worse. Here he is on Howard Stern's radio show trying to explain his sympathy for victims of sexual misconduct.
You know, you'd have to have Down syndrome.
Not to know that.
My new word.
Down syndrome. Right, that's a good word.
You'd have to have Down syndrome to not feel sorry for, you know. Of course, Me too is what you want for your daughters.
Eric, that's pretty awkward. What happened next?
Yeah. So Norm MacDonald went on The View and tried to explain that he was trying to avoid using a different word. I think the word he was trying to avoid using was the R word that we use to refer to mentally incapacitated people. And so in trying to avoid using that word, he used another word. You know, ultimately, I think Norm MacDonald's appeal as a comic has always been that he's been somewhat unfiltered. And he's also kind of an old school comic. He's older and he enjoys leaning into that. And so I feel like he, like a lot of comics, older comics have not figured out how to talk about some issues in a modern age without being insulting. And what's interesting to me about Netflix is because Netflix is trying to have all these different kinds of comics on its platform, we are really seeing this sort of friction between how younger comics talk about race, identity, gender, things like that, and how older comics are dealing with it. So we've got Norm MacDonald, not on his show, but in other venues, saying things that people don't appreciate about these very sensitive topics.
Regardless of how you feel about it, Norm MacDonald has a show. It's out. and he's a guy who got famous for Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. He's a freewheeler. He's deadpan. How does the style that you're describing here translate to the interviews on this new program?
Well, it makes the show kind of a hit and miss proposition. But he got the show in part because David Letterman may have recommended him or talked about him or was involved in some way. He's credited as the location scout on the show. Not quite sure what that means. But then when Letterman came on the show, Norm was trying so hard to make him laugh with sort of eccentric jokes that it felt really weird, and it wasn't that funny. So we have a clip of Norm trying to do this offbeat impression of an actor from a film called The Candidate, while Letterman is trying to figure out, like, what exactly is he doing? Okay. Let's check it out.
Yep. Is this going anywhere?
Yeah. It's going to my impression of Robert Shaw. He brings Robert Redford into his office, and he says this. You're past posting, Kelly, aren't you? How?
I feel like I'm on a show in another country.
Eric, I don't get it. I don't get it.
You have to have seen the movie to get it, and the movie is from, like, the 70s, yeah. Of course, you know.
Well, maybe that's part of the humor. I don't know.
No, I think it was this weird sort of offhand moment that McDonald found funny from the movie. And the people around him are laughing because
they have to.
Well, in part because they want to save the moment. But also, I think because that's part of what McDonald does, is he sort of creates these uncomfortable moments. And the absurdity of that uncomfortableness is part of the show. Hmm. So when he talked to Drew Barrymore, for example, he cracked a lot of jokes that she didn't understand, in part because she's too young and in part because her mind doesn't work that way. But it was funny that she didn't get it. And we have a clip. Let's play that.
Actors look on me the way vampires look on Count Chocula.
But you know what? I don't get it. I have to admit, I don't get it. What is the Dracula thinking when he's looking at the Count Chocula?
I love that you call him the Dracula.
All right, Eric, Drew Barrymore's 43 years old. She's not that young. That's a reference to what, cereal or something?
So his point was that Count Chocula is a fake vampire. Actors look at him and think he's not a real actor. Now, she didn't get it. But because she sort of had fun with him, it was still kind of a funny, interesting moment. And in fact, he basically avoided explaining to her what he meant. Hmm. He enjoys those moments. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. And when he's with somebody who doesn't want to play in that way, it can be very weird.
Huh. So big picture, is this investment in Norm Macdonald going to work for them?
Well, you know, before this week, I would have said it might have been an interesting experiment. They seem to be trying to figure out a way to do kind of a new school talk show for Netflix audiences, and they haven't quite figured that out. And before, you know, the last couple of days, I might have said the Norm Macdonald show might be a step towards figuring that out. But now his brand has been so damaged, I don't know how that show's going to do.
All right. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Glad we could fit Count Chocula into that interview. Mm. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.